This is a reading of the autobiography of Rudolf Steiner, titled Chapters in the Course of My Life, 1861 to 1907. I'm on chapter 28. It was also during that time that I found Goethe's fairy tale, The Green Snake and the Beautiful Lily, very significant, and I studied it thoroughly. It constitutes the final chapter of his Conversations of German Emigrants. There have been many interpretations of this enigmatic tale, but I was not concerned with any interpretation of its meaning. I wanted only to accept it as an artistic poem. I have always found it distasteful when the creative imagination of a work is pulverized by intellectualizing. I saw that this poetic work of Goethe had arisen from his discussions and exchanges of ideas with Schiller. Entitled Letters on the Aesthetic Education of Man, Schiller was in the philosophic phase of his development. Self-comprehension of human consciousness was a soul task that Schiller was deeply concerned with. He saw, on the one hand, the human soul given to active reason. Schiller felt that the soul, when working in pure reason, does not depend on the physical, sensory, perceptible nature. Yet he sensed something unsatisfying in such suprasensory activity. The soul, it is true, is within spirit, when surrendered to the necessary logic of reason. But in that surrender, the soul is neither free nor inwardly alive spiritually. The soul surrenders to an abstract, shadowy image of spirit, but does not weave and assert itself in the true life and being of spirit. On the other hand, Schiller observed that human soul life also surrenders to an opposite kind of activity, one in which it is completely bound by bodily nature, with sensory perception and instincts. In this case, the shadowy images of spirit are ineffective and lose their power. The soul is surrendered to the laws of nature, which do not constitute the soul's true being. Schiller concluded that in neither of these activities is one a true human being. But we can ourselves bring about something neither given by nature nor given by the rational shadow of spirit that arises independent of our activity. We can bring reason into our physical activity, lifting the physical to a higher level of consciousness so that it acts like spirit. Thus we develop an inner disposition that is midway between logic and natural necessity. To Schiller, this is our character when we live in the artistic element. Aesthetic comprehension of the world sees the sensory perceptible, but in such a way that it finds spirit there. It lives in the shadows cast by spirit through the act of creating or enjoying. It gives spirit a sensory form, so that it no longer has only a shadowy existence. Years before, Schiller's struggle toward a view of the true human had come to my attention, and this came to mind as Goethe's cryptic fairy tale became a riddle for me. I saw how Goethe had taken up Schiller's description of the truly human. There was a vital question for both of them. How does shadowy spirit in the soul find physical manifestation? And how does nature in the physical body work its way up to spirit? Schiller's notion was too abstract and narrowly philosophical for Goethe. This can be seen in their correspondence and from what is known of their spiritual exchanges. Goethe created charming images, the river separating two worlds, the will-o'-the-wisps trying to cross from one world to the other, the snakes self-sacrifice to build a bridge between the two worlds. The beautiful lily can be seen only as reigning in spirit, beyond the river by those who live on this side, and much more. Goethe contrasted Schiller's philosophical solution with a poetic view in the form of a fairy tale. He felt that if we use philosophical arguments to solve the mystery of the soul recognized by Schiller, we are inwardly impoverished as we search for our true being. Goethe wanted to approach the mystery through the riches of soul experience. Goethe's poetic images recall the imaginations often described before his time by those seeking a path to spirit. We find an image like that of the three kings in the fairy tale in the chemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz. Other figures are the reappearance of earlier images of the path of knowing. Goethe, however, turned those pictures into beautiful, noble, artistic imaginations, whereas earlier pictures were less artistic. In his fairy tale, Goethe led the creative imagination very near the boundary where inner soul comes to know the spiritual world. I believe that one could acquire a deep understanding of Goethe's soulful nature by delving into his poetic work. Explaining the fairy tale was not important to me. The important thing was the way I was stimulated inwardly by working with it. This invigoration continued to work further in my soul life until it was expressed in the mystery dramas I wrote later. The fairy tale, however, did not really help me very much in my work on Goethe. It seemed as if Goethe had grown beyond his own worldview when he created that poetic work, as though compelled by the inner power of a semi-conscious soul life. This caused me a serious difficulty. Though it no longer satisfied me, I was obliged to continue to interpret Goethe's work for Kirchner's German National Literature as I had before. I realized that while writing the fairy tale, Goethe had looked across the boundary, as it were, into the spiritual world. Yet, when he writes later of natural processes, he does not consider his glimpse into the spiritual world. Thus, I could not justify using that glimpse as the basis for interpreting his work. Even if I had gained nothing through my work on Goethe, as I absorbed myself in the fairy tale, my inner life was abundantly stimulated. The fairy tale provided me with significant material for meditation, to which I returned repeatedly. The fairy tale became a preparation for the work I began later in Weimar. I led a very active social life during that period. I often saw old friends, and though I had little opportunity to speak about the matters I am speaking of here, strong soul and spiritual bonds united me with those friends. I often recall the endless discussions in a well-known coffee house in Michaelerplatz in Vienna. I was reminded of them especially when the Austrian Empire fell apart right after the World War. Even at that time, the conditions that led to that disintegration were everywhere. At the time, however, no one was willing to acknowledge this. Everyone had an idea about how to correct matters, each according to a particular national or cultural inclination. The ideals inspired by times of progress are uplifting. They are tragic in equal measure when they become attempts to prevent decline. Such tragic ideals were stirring in the souls of the finest people of Vienna and all of Austria. I often upset those idealists by airing the conviction I gained by intimately studying Goethe's era, the conviction that Western culture had reached a high point, and that the height of that development had not been sustained. Our scientific age, which affects individuals as well as whole cultures, indicates a decline. Before it can progress further, it needs an entirely new spiritual impulse. To continue the spiritual trends followed thus far will lead only to a reversal. Goethe represents the peak of a certain evolution, but its final stage, rather than a beginning. He gathers the fruits of development that led up to him, and it culminated in him in its fullest form. Progress cannot, however, continue without far more original sources of spiritual experience than those contained in that development. This was my mood as I wrote the last part of my exposition on Goethe. I continued to be occupied with such thoughts when I encountered Nietzsche's writings. Titled Beyond Good and Evil was the first book I read by him. As with others, I was both attracted and repelled by his views. I had difficulty coming to terms with Nietzsche. I loved his style and boldness, but I did not care for the way he addressed the most profound problems, without first immersing himself in them with spiritual soul experience. It seemed, however, that much of what Nietzsche had to say was intimately close to my own spiritual experience. Consequently, I felt a certain kinship with his struggle, and I had to find a way to express that relationship. To me, Nietzsche was one of the most tragic figures of the time. I believed that the whole cultural trend of our scientific age could result only in such a tragedy for souls who tended to be sensitive and discriminating. Those were my feelings during my final years in Vienna. The end of chapter 28. Chapter 29. I had the opportunity to visit Budapest and Transylvania before that first period of my life came to an end. The young man from Transylvania I mentioned, who had remained a loyal friend throughout those many years, had introduced me to a number of his fellow Transylvanians living in Vienna. Consequently, in addition to my other broad social circle, I had something like it with those from Transylvania. Among them were Herr and Frau Breitenstein, who at that time became close friends, and have remained so since. For a long time they had a leading position in the Anthroposophical Society in Vienna. That friendship with people from Transylvania led to my visit to Budapest. The capital of Hungary, so very different from Vienna, made a deep impression on me. The journey from Vienna to Budapest was distinguished by charming scenery, temperamental, lively people, and stirring music. Looking out of the train window, one had the impression that nature has a special poetry, but this usual mood in nature is hardly noticed by those who hurry about, stirred by the deeper inner music of their own hearts. Entering Budapest, one also enters a world that stimulates the interest of other Europeans, although it is a world they will never fully understand. It is a dark foundation beneath a colorful play of light. For me, all this was summed up in the statue of Franz Dieck. A rough, proud, courageous will was expressed in the head of that man who created the Hungary of 1867 to 1918. It was without cunning, but had an elemental relentlessness. I felt that, though subjective, it was true for every real Hungarian that there is no life outside of Hungary, and if there is, it's no life. As a child at the western border of Hungary, I had seen the effect that this rough, proud will had on the Germans. Now in the heart of Hungary, I saw how this characteristic tends to isolate the Magyars. With a certain naivete and clothed in natural glory, that will is concerned with revealing itself to the hidden eyes of nature, but not to open human eyes. 6 months later at Christmas, my friends from Transylvania arranged for me to give a lecture in Hermannstadt. I traveled across the wide plains, at the center of which is Arad, and as my eyes wandered over the plains, an expansive, unobstructed panorama, I could hear Lenau's poems, charged with longing within me. I had to stay overnight in a village near the border between Hungary and Transylvania. I sat half the night in the inn's common room. In addition to myself, there were only some men playing cards at a table. Every nationality in Hungary and Transylvania was represented, and they played with great passion. Explosive outbursts occurred every half hour, and gathered like clouds of fighting demons, as it were, above the table, robbing them of all human dignity. What differences of national character were expressed in that passion! I arrived at Hermannstadt Christmas Day. There I was introduced to the Transylvanian Saxons living amid the Romanians and Magyars. They were noble people who courageously worked to preserve their national customs and culture, and they were unwilling to admit that their battle was hopeless. In their desire to remain loyal to their heritage, they erected a kind of memorial to their culture of earlier centuries, before it had been driven eastward. But, in exile, it showed signs of losing contact with the world, and this manifested everywhere as an artificial festive quality. I spent a pleasant time with the German Protestant clergy, with teachers from the German schools, and with other Germans living in Transylvania. My heart felt warmed among those people, who, in caring for and nurturing their folk ways, had developed a culture of heart that in turn spoke mainly to the heart. This vital warmth lived in my soul as we wrapped ourselves in thick fur and, old and new friends together, took a sleigh ride south to the Carpathian, the Transylvanian Alps. The air was icy and the snow crackled under the sleigh. In the distance the Alps appeared as a black, mountainous wall covered in woods. As we drew closer, became a wild, fissured mountain landscape, often very forbidding. My central experience there was a result of my longtime friend, He was always thinking of new ways to better acquaint me with Transylvanian Saxony. At the time, he still divided his time between Vienna and Hermannstadt, and had started a weekly paper in Hermannstadt to help cultivate the Saxon nationality in Transylvania. That venture was purely idealistic, undertaken with absolutely no practical experience. Nevertheless, most of those who represented the Saxons helped out. It went under after a few weeks. Destiny provided me with experiences such as this journey, and such experiences enabled me to cultivate my awareness of external phenomena and circumstances, which was not easy for me, whereas everything spiritual was self-evident to me. With the sadness of memories, I returned to Vienna. Soon a book came into my hands, titled Rembrandt as Educator, which was highly praised by everyone for its wealth of spiritual insight, in quotes. In discussions everywhere, the book was always praised for, quote, its entirely new spiritual impulse, unquote. This in particular brought home to me how very lonely I was with my spiritual views in contemporary spiritual life. My impression of that widely praised book was this. It was as though for several months someone spent every night in a somewhat upper-class tavern listening to all the brilliant remarks of certain regular customers who were important. They were written in the form of aphorisms as they arose. After this, quote, preliminary work, unquote, they were assembled on slips of paper into a bowl and, after a good shake, taken out and joined, one after the other, until a book is produced. Of course, such criticism is an exaggeration, but my own view of life forced me to strongly reject that book. A book nevertheless highly praised by the Zeitgeist. I found title Rembrandt as Educator completely superficial and pretentious. No sentence even touches the true depth of soul life. It was painful to find my contemporaries accepting such a book as a serious work by a person of depth. I believed that such superficial thoughts paddle in shallow waters of the spirit and serve only to drive true deep humanity from souls. The end of chapter 29. Chapter 30. I had begun tutoring when I was 14. Destiny firmly held me in that work for 15 years, until the second chapter of my life began my work in Weimar. Thus, during my childhood and youth, the development of many others was connected with my own. This enabled me to observe how differently the masculine and feminine genders grow into life. In addition to tutoring boys and young men, I also tutored a number of young girls. I even taught geometry to the mother of the boy whose education I oversaw because of his pathological condition. Another time I tutored her and her sister in aesthetics. For several years that boy's family became a kind of home. From there I visited other families as tutor and instructor. Through my friendship with the boy's mother I shared all the joys and sorrows of the family. That woman appeared to me as an exceptionally beautiful human soul. She was completely devoted to the unfolding destiny of her four sons. One could study the great form that motherly love assumed in her. Working with her on matters of education provided my own life with beautiful meaning. She was talented and very enthusiastic about music. When they were still young, she herself assumed part of her sons' lessons in music. She discussed with me many various life problems with sharp interest and great understanding. She took a real interest and understood much. She was also very interested in my scientific and other work. That was a time when I felt the need most deeply to discuss with her all that was deeply concerned me. When I spoke of my spiritual experiences, she listened in an unusual way. That subject appealed to her reason, which nevertheless remained somewhat reserved, but her soul accepted it all. Her view of human nature was colored somewhat by naturalism. She viewed the soul's moral disposition as entirely related to a healthy or unhealthy physical constitution. In other words, her medical view of the human being was instinctive and was consequently somewhat naturalistic. I found it quite invigorating to discuss such things with her. Furthermore, she accomplished the tasks given her by life with a strong sense of duty, though many of them, in her view, did not belong to her at all. She felt many aspects of her destiny as a burden, but she demanded nothing from life and accepted what life brought, provided it did not affect her sons. She experienced all that concerned them with very strong emotions. Thus I shared a mother's beautiful devotion to her sons, her inner work, and the daily life of a family with a large circle of relatives and friends. Nevertheless, it had its difficulties. The family was Jewish. It was their view that they were quite free of sectarian or racial limitations. But the father, to whom I was very attached, was extremely sensitive to any remark by a non-Jew about Jews. This was the result of anti-Semitic feelings flaring up at the time. At that time, I became very interested in the Germans' struggle for national existence in Austria, and this interest led me to look at the historical and social situations of the Jews. I was busy with this in particular when Hammerling's Homunculus was published. It caused that eminent German author to be seen among journalists as anti-Semitic. Indeed, German anti-Semites claimed him as one of their own. This did not concern me, but I wrote an article about Homunculus, in which I thought I expressed myself quite objectively about the position of Judaism. But the man who was my friend, and in whose house I was living, saw my article as a certain kind of anti-Semitism. His feelings of friendship were not lessened because of it, but he was deeply hurt. After reading the article, he turned to me, filled with pain, and said, quote, "What you have written here cannot be interpreted as friendly, but the thing that really troubles me is that it was your close relationship with us and our friends that provided you with the experiences that allowed you to write about Jews this way." Unquote. He was wrong, however. My article was based solely on a survey of cultural history. There was nothing personal in my judgments, but he was unable to see this. His response to my explanation was, quote, "No, according to this article, the man who is teaching my children is no friend of the Jews." Unquote. Nothing could convince him otherwise. Nevertheless, he would not consider for a moment that my relationship to the family should change. He viewed it as a necessity. And even less could I allow this situation to cause a change, because I saw the education of his son as a task given to me by destiny. Neither of us could avoid feeling that something tragic had entered our relationship. And there was something else that aggravated the situation. The national struggle had caused the views of many of my friends to be colored with anti-Semitism. They were averse to my position in a Jewish household, and the head of that household simply saw his impression of my article confirmed in those friendships. Ignaz Bruhl, the composer of titled The Golden Cross, was connected with that family whose life I shared. He was subtle, and I was immensely fond of him. Bruhl was somewhat withdrawn from the world and self-absorbed. His interests were not limited to music. He was interested in many aspects of spiritual life. He was limited in his pursuit of these interests, however, because he was favored by destiny with an easy life and a family that protected him from its usual cares. This situation made its mark on the work he produced. He did not grow fully into life, but more into music. The merit of his musical productions do not concern us here, but it was delightful to meet him in the street and watch him awake from his world of tones as one spoke to him. He generally failed to match the buttons with the correct buttonholes on his vest. His expression was gentle and thoughtful, and his walk, while not firm, was very expressive. One could talk with him about many things, and he would have a sensitive understanding of it, though one saw how the subject of the conversation would soon slip into the realm of music. Through the family I lived with, I met the distinguished physician Dr. Breuer, who, with Dr. Freud, led to the birth of psychoanalysis. Dr. Breuer, however, shared this outlook only in the beginning. It is unlikely that he agreed with the way it was developed later by Freud. Dr. Breuer was a fascinating person. I admired him as a physician, but he also had a broad range of interests in other fields. He spoke with inspiration about Shakespeare. His profound medical knowledge added much that was interesting to what he said about Ibsen or about Tolstoy's title Kreutzer Sonata. I eagerly listened when he discussed subjects with my friend, the mother whose children I was educating. Psychoanalysis was not yet born, but the psychological problems were already there. Hypnotism had given the medical way of thinking a certain coloring. My friend and Dr. Breuer had been friends since her youth. One fact gave me much to think about. In certain respects, her understanding of medicine was deeper than that of the distinguished physician. Once they discussed the case of a morphine addict Dr. Breuer was treating. Referring to the conversation, she said to me, quote, "Just imagine what Dr. Breuer did. He made the morphine addict promise on his word of honor not to touch morphine again. Dr. Breuer actually expected results in this way and became indignant when the patient failed to keep his word. He said, 'How can I treat someone who will not keep a promise?' Can you believe such a distinguished doctor would be that naive? How can anyone think that something so deeply rooted in the man's nature could be cured by a promise?" Unquote. Nevertheless, my friend may not have been entirely correct. The doctor's ideas on the therapeutic value of suggestion may have been part of an attempt to achieve a cure. But one cannot deny that my friend's statement vigorously illustrates the very spirit of the Viennese school of medicine at its flowering. In her own way, this friend was a significant individual. Although she died a long time ago, she played an important role in my life. Among other things, having to part from her made it difficult to leave Vienna. The end of chapter 30. Chapter 31. Looking back at that first period of my life, and attempting to describe it externally, I must acknowledge that destiny guided me in such a way that by the time I was 30, I was still unfettered by any worldly profession. Even when I joined the Goethe-Schiller archives in Weimar, it was not with the purpose of taking a permanent position, but to be an independent collaborator on the Goethe edition, to be published by the archives through a commission of the Grand Duchess Sophie. A report was published by the director of the archives. It appeared in the 12th volume of the Goethe yearbook with this statement, quote, "In autumn 1890, Rudolf Steiner of Vienna joined the permanent staff. The whole field of morphology, except for the osteological portion, has been assigned to him. It will constitute 5, possibly 6 volumes in the second section, and will contain extremely important material from the literary legacy." End quote. Again, I faced a task of indefinite duration. It had arisen not from any external cause, but directly from the inner development of my view of life and the world. Thus, it also happened that I took my doctorate examination at Rostock University, which included my dissertation that attempted to show how human consciousness can comprehend itself. Circumstances alone prevented my receiving a degree in Vienna. I had pursued a gymnasium education privately, and even tutored students in it, but officially my education was that of Realschule, not Gymnasium. In Austria, this fact prevented any possibility of earning a doctorate. I was well grounded in philosophy, but my official education kept me from everything to which the study of philosophy gives access. It happened that toward the end of the first chapter of my life, I got hold of a philosophical work titled The 7 Books of Platonism, that deeply aroused my interest. The author Heinrich von Stein was teaching philosophy at the time at Rostock University, which led me to submit my dissertation to this lovable old philosopher. I saw him only at the examination, but I had come to value him through his book. The personality of von Stein still comes vividly to mind, as though I had known him intimately. Titled The 7 Books of Platonism, expresses a deep philosophic individuality. In that work, philosophy is not treated as a thought content resting on its own foundation. Plato is regarded as the greatest of philosophers, who searched for just such a self-supporting philosophy. What he discovered in this way, Heinrich von Stein presents in detail. In the first chapters, one enters the Platonic worldview entirely. But then Stein goes on to describe the Christ revelation breaking into human evolution. He places this real breakthrough of spiritual life at a higher level than the mere elaboration of a philosophy. Stein's description could be characterized as the fulfillment of the human goal of going from Platonism to Christianity. He continues by tracing how Platonism worked further within the evolution of Christianity. In Stein's view, the revelation of Christ gave philosophy its content from outside. I was unable to agree with him. I knew that the Christ revelation can become an inner experience, once we have understood our own true being in spiritually awake consciousness. The Christ revelation can then become an inner, living reality in the human being through the conscious experience of ideas. But something in Stein's book greatly appealed to me. The impulse that led to this comprehensive historical and philosophical description was the real life of the spirit behind the life of ideas, though not as I experienced it. Stein's book presents Plato as the great bearer of an idea world that waited to be fulfilled through the Christ impulse. This book, despite what I opposed, was much closer to my own way of thinking than all the philosophies whose content merely formed an edifice of abstract concepts derived from sensory experience. In Stein, I also missed the recognition that Plato's ideas do lead back to a spiritual, primordial revelation of the spiritual world. This pre-Christian revelation has, for example, been described sympathetically by Otto Willmann in his title History of Idealism. It does not enter Stein's consideration at all. He does not present Platonism as the last vestige of a primordial revelation in conceptual form, one that, through Christianity, regains its lost spiritual content in a higher form. Rather, he presents Platonic ideas as though spun from themselves, conceptual content that later attains life through Christ. Nevertheless, Stein's book is one of those written with philosophical warmth. Its author was a person permeated with a deep feeling for religion, the expression of which he sought in philosophy. On every page of the three-volume work, one encounters the personality of its author. Thus it was very significant for me to meet the author in person after having read his book many times, especially the parts about the relationship between Platonism and Christianity. He was very old and serene, his gentle expression suggesting he would follow his student's progress kindly, yet thoroughly. His voice had a tone that revealed in every sentence the deliberation of the philosopher. That was my immediate impression of Stein when I met him prior to the examination. He said, quote, "Your dissertation is not done as required. It is clear that you have not been under the guidance of a professor. However, its content is such that I gladly accept it." Unquote. During the oral examination, I greatly hoped for questions relating to titled The Seven Books of Platonism, but they never arose. Everything was related to the philosophy of Kant. I have carried the image of Heinrich von Stein deeply impressed in my heart. I would dearly have loved to have met him again, but destiny did not bring this about. My doctoral examination is one of my most treasured memories, because the impression of Stein's personality outshines all else connected with it. I arrived in Weimar still influenced by the mood of my thorough study of Platonism. I believe this helped me greatly to find my way into my work at the Goethe-Schiller archives. How did Plato live in the world of ideas, and how did Goethe? This question occupied me as I made my way to and from the archives. It occupied me also as I studied the papers of the Goethe estate. This question was at the back of my mind early in 1891, when I expressed my impressions of Goethe's knowledge of nature in these words, quote, "Most people find it impossible to imagine that someone requiring totally subjective conditions in order to manifest can nevertheless have a validity that is objective and substantial. The quote-unquote archetypal plant, Urpflanze, is in this very category. It is the objective essence of plant, contained in all plants. In order, however, for it to become perceptibly existent, the human being's spirit must independently construct it." Parenthesis quote, "Concerning the results of our views of Goethe's natural scientific works through the publication of the Goethe Archives, unquote, Goethe Yearbook, Volume 12, parenthesis, end quote. Or in these words, quote, "A correct understanding of Goethe's thinking allows the possibility of deciding whether it is correct, according to Goethe's view, to identify the archetypal plant or the archetypal animal with a physical organic form that exists at a specific time or has yet to appear. A decisive no is the only answer possible. Every plant contains the archetypal plant. The constructive power of the spirit can obtain it from the world of plants, but no individual plant form can be said to be the prototype." End quote. The end of chapter 31. Chapter 32. I had become a co-worker in the Goethe-Schiller archives. This was the institute where, at the end of the 19th century, philologists had assumed Goethe's literary estate. Bernard Souffan was the director of the archives. My relationship with him, I can say, was personal from the very first day of my Weimar period, and I was often privileged to be a guest in his home. Bernard Souffan was a friend of Hermann Grimm. This led him to succeed Erich Schmidt, who was the first director of the archives. Goethe's last descendant, Walter von Goethe, had left Goethe's literary estate to the Grand Duchess Sophie. She established the archives so that his legacy would become appropriately incorporated into the culture. Naturally, she turned to those whom she assumed would know what to do with Goethe's manuscripts. The first of these was Herr von Löper. He was predestined, so to speak, to mediate between the Goethe experts and the royal court at Weimar, which had been entrusted to administer Goethe's literary legacy. Löper maintained a high position in the Prussian cabinet, and thus had a close connection with the Queen of Prussia, sister of the Grand Duke of Weimar. Furthermore, he was the most important associate in the well-known Hempel edition of Goethe. Löper was a peculiar person, a very congenial mixture of the worldly and the eccentric. He was not a professional, but through his admiration for Goethe's work, he found his way into Goethe research, and he had distinguished himself in this way. He was entirely independent in his assessment of Goethe. An excellent example of this is his edition of Faust. What he presented, he had learned from Goethe himself. Now that he had to give advice as to who would be best suited to look after Goethe's literary estate, he had to rely on the Goethe scholars, with whom he had close contact through his own Goethe research. His first choice was Hermann Grimm, who approached Goethe as an art historian. In this capacity, he had given a course of lectures on Goethe at the University of Berlin, later published as a book. At the same time, however, he could consider himself a kind of spiritual descendant of Goethe. He came from circles of German culture that had preserved a living tradition of Goethe, and therefore to some degree could consider themselves personally connected with him. Grimm's wife, Gisela von Arnim, was the daughter of Bettina, who wrote the book titled Goethe's Correspondence with the Child. Grimm assessed Goethe as an art enthusiast, but even as an art historian, he was never scholarly, unless it accorded with his personally colored appreciation of art. I think that Grimm got along easily with Löper, who had become a friend because of their mutual interest in Goethe. It seems to me that in their discussions on Goethe, the topic revolved around their interest in Goethe's genius from a human standpoint rather than a scholarly one. On the other hand, it was natural for Wilhelm Scherer, the professor of German literature at the University of Berlin, to consider Goethe from the scholarly perspective. The two others had to acknowledge him as the official Goethe expert. Löper did this in a childlike, harmless way, and Grimm with an inner resistance, since he really did not care for Scherer's philological approach. Basically, the administration of Goethe's literary estate was in the hands of these three men. In fact, however, it slipped entirely into the hands of Scherer. Löper, no doubt, considered himself to be only an advisor, collaborating in the work from the outside. He had firm social connections through his position in the Royal House of Prussia. Neither did Grimm consider himself more than an outside advisor. His cultural obligations kept him from giving more than advice and viewpoints for the work. He could not be responsible for the details. Things were different for Wilhelm Scherer. To him, Goethe represented an important chapter in the history of German literature, and new, immensely important sources for this chapter had to come to light in the Goethe archives. The work of the archives, therefore, had to be incorporated systematically into the general works of historical literature. The plan arose to produce an edition of Goethe's works, arranged according to the requirements of philology. Scherer assumed the spiritual supervision, and Erich Schmidt, his follower, who occupied the chair of modern German history of literature at Vienna, was entrusted to administer the archives. This gave a kind of identity to the work at the Goethe archives. It also left its stamp on everything else that happened there and took place through it. Everything bore the character of the contemporary philological method of thinking and working. As he worked philologically on the history of literature, Wilhelm Scherer tried to duplicate scientific methods. He used the prevailing scientific ideas as his models for ideas on philology and literary history. He based the historical development of culture on certain questions. What was the source of a poet's material, and how had it been modified? Thus the personality of the poet disappeared. Instead, there was the question of how the subject matter and motif developed through the personality of the writer. Erich Schmidt's long monograph on Lessing is a classic example of this approach at its zenith. The main interest is not the personality of Lessing, but a detailed consideration of motifs, such as those of Mina von Barnhelm, or title Nathan. I think Mina von Barnhelm is a title as well. Scherer died young, soon after the Goethe Archives was established. He had many students. Erich Schmidt was called from the Goethe Archives to take over Scherer's work in Berlin. Hermann Grimm made certain that the leadership of the archives was passed on to Bernard Suffan, rather than one of Scherer's many students. Bernard Suffan had previously taught at a gymnasium in Berlin, while he had also edited Herder's writings. I don't know if I'm pronouncing Suffan correctly. It's Suphan, but I am pronouncing it Suffan. Through this, he seemed favorably predetermined to assume the guidance of the Goethe edition. Since Erich Schmidt retained a certain influence, Scherer's spirit could still be felt in the Goethe work, but Grimm's ideas were expressed much more strongly, if not so much in the method of working, then certainly in the personal interactions within the archives. Bernard Suffan had already known great personal trials when I became personally acquainted with him after I arrived in Weimar. He had been married twice, and both wives, who were sisters, had died young. He now lived in Weimar with his two sons, mourning those he had lost, unhappy with life. The only brightness in his existence was the kindness of the Grand Duchess Sophie toward him. Suffan honored the Grand Duchess. There was nothing servile in his respect for her, for he loved and admired her purely as a person. He was greatly attached to Hermann Grimm. Earlier in Berlin, Suffan had enjoyed the cultural atmosphere of the Grimm's household, where he was seen as one of the family. But there was something in Suffan's makeup that kept him from coming to terms with life. Indeed, it was possible to discuss with him the most sublime spiritual matters, but it easily happened that something sour arising from his feeling would enter the conversation. That sour quality dominated his inner soul life. He sought relief from it by means of a dry humor, which prevented any warmth from entering one's relationship with him. He could express with complete sympathy some exalted subject, and in the same breath, without warning, fall to something petty and trivial. He always showed goodwill toward me, but he did not share the spiritual interests that stirred me so deeply, and often made them a topic of his dry humor. Nevertheless, he took a warm interest in my work at the archives, and in my personal life. I cannot deny that I often felt disturbed by what Suffan did, the way he handled the management of the archives, and his supervision of the editing of Goethe's works, and I never made any secret of this. But when I look back at the years spent with him, a strong feeling of sympathy with his personal destiny, so severely tested by life, outweighs all else. He suffered through life, and he suffered through himself. I witnessed how, with all the good sides of his character and his abilities, he sank more and more into a bottomless pit of meaningless brooding that arose in his soul. When the Goethe-Schiller archives were moved to a new building erected on the Ilm, Suffan said that he felt like a human sacrifice in relation to opening that building, something like those walled up at the entrance to sacred buildings in ancient times to bless the activities within. And in fact, he gradually came to fantasize that he was being sacrificed for a cause with which he felt no real connection. He felt like a beast of burden under the Goethe work, with no pleasure in a task that others might have shouldered with the greatest enthusiasm. After I had left Weimar, I always found him in this mood whenever I met him. He ended his life by suicide in a darkened mental condition. The end of chapter 32 and the end of this reading. of the autobiography, this section of the biography.